Maybe just a few words, but very, very briefly to know. So I'm a philosopher. I'm teaching, as Claude said yesterday. I teach in Tours, in the med school in Tours, and I have two research teams, one in neuroscience, actually. It's called INSERM U930, working on affective disorder. Guess what? Exactly, the topic I will talk about and I'm working on currently. And the other team consists of philosophers of science. Okay, so my starting point would be, as an introduction, this question: what does biologization involve? I mean, what does, of course, what biologization of depression involves? This is my first question, and I think you will not wonder that it is a philosophical question, because many philosophers and social scientists have asked that same kind of question. So MDE stands for major depressive episode, MDD for major depressive disorder. Okay, so here I'm talking about major depressive episode. What I want to say first is two introductory remarks on biologization. The first one is that the notion of depression is not something created anew from, discoveries about neurobiology in the 20th century. It has been, of course, a notion with a great, long, very long history. So what I mean is that scientists cannot consider in the first place that what they are talking about is something that they are creating. That would be very strange. It's not, if so to speak, we could just say that, for instance, methylation is a concept that scientists can consider they are creating. Okay, to take just one example. But depression, it's not the case. For depression, it's something that exists. I mean that if we had a completely new notion of what depression is, people would say, well, it's very interesting what you're telling us about, but it's not depression. It's something else. Okay, it's not that it's not interesting, it's not that it's not a disease, it's just that it's not just not what we call depression. So they have to take that into account. Okay, so there are concepts like that in science. From time to time, you have to take into account what people think is the object you are talking about. Okay, so that will be my first remark. And this has very important consequences. I mean, the more important ones, I will go more into details further, but the more important one is that what scientists are doing is trying basically to keep the same extension for this concept, meaning the same set of patients that people will call depressed people, but they have to change the intention of the term, that is, the meaning of the term. Okay, why is that so? Because you will define depression in a neurobiological way, with neurobiological terms, phenomena, processes, and so on. Okay? So this is important because this is the problem itself is there or lies there. My second remark will be that this very situation I just briefly described raises three puzzles that I will try to describe, but very briefly, because I don't want I'd rather discuss it with you. These puzzles are the following ones: what I call the problem of framing clinical symptoms, that is, finding the right way of describing them. And the second problem will be how to build causal models, okay, of what happens within the brain of a depressed person. And the third problem will be rather a problem for epidemiologists, which means that we also have to build a consistent class of patients for the study to be, any studies to be possible. So these are the three problems I saw in this field. I mean, and I should say not field, but this bunch of fields, or set of fields that psychiatry consists in today. Okay, so, and maybe I should add something more. This, what I'm presenting right now, is the, let's say it's my first ideas about a book I'd like to write in probably in the following month or at least a year. And I'm trying to test with you some of my hypotheses, let's say. So that would be the general framework of the book. I'd like to go into each of these problems into more details in the book. Okay, so I will just briefly describe the first problem, framing clinical symptoms. Traditionally, if you go to philosophers of neuroscience, they will say that, and probably some of you have thought of the problem in exactly the terms of what we call sometimes reduction or elimination. Okay, so if you try to neurobiologize symptoms, for a philosopher mind, it seems to mean or imply reduction or elimination. What I want to suggest here is that this is really unfortunate. We should not take these terms of reduction or elimination in consideration, because they are basically no use, at least for this particular problem. I prefer to use a less committed term, like, for instance, redefinition. So what we are trying to do is just redefine. And I will give an example just now. So let's take the clinical definition for depression. Let's take, for instance, the one that you can find in Hippocrates, for instance. A very short definition, very interesting and very elegant definition. Melancholia is supposed to be fear or sadness lasting for a long time. Very excellent definition, very interesting definition. Very short, very interesting. Just maybe I should note something. There is this term sadness in it. But as you can note, fear for a long time, we would not call melancholia today, or depression. We would call anxiety disorders, something like that, but not depression. Okay. Sadness translates here the term dysthymia, in Greek, which is not exactly sadness, but means rather something like disorder or maladaptation of emotions or desires or drives or something like that. Not their absence either, but just something like a lack of attunement to the environment, let's say, something like that. Also, I should say that it's something that is also vague in a way, because, for instance, psychiatrists have discovered and described different states that could be described as dysthymia. For instance, abulia, or apatheia, or atimormia, for instance, all are related and slightly different. Some psychiatrists would say, well, I know very well what the difference is between apatheia and, for instance, dysthymia, or anhedonia, for instance. But I'm not sure that it is very clear, actually, which means that there is some kind of, we said plasticity this morning, plasticity of the term maybe, or something like at least a vague meaning, which means that there is room for change in these terms. They can be used and change. Okay, so let's go to the definition you can find of this special symptom I just described, anhedonia, in the DSM-5. The definition is, you can see, for the major symptom for depression is defined as follows. It's a markedly diminished interest or pleasure in all or almost all activities, most of the day, nearly every day. Okay, this is the standard definition of one important symptom for depression. Okay. So to be depressed, you have to be either to have that or low mood and a bunch of other symptoms. Okay. And within this very definition, you can find something that is defined elsewhere in the DSM as anhedonia. That is, quote, the decreased ability to experience pleasure from positive stimuli, or a degradation in the recollection of pleasure previously experienced. Okay, that's a definition. That's a clinical definition. So my point is that is to show now how this kind of definition can change or can be redefined neurobiologically. I will do that very briefly. I won't have the time to go into details. But let's say that just as a starting point, that one psychiatrist in 1987 made a distinction in the clinics between what he called liking and wanting. Okay, two kinds of behaviors. You can like something or you can want something. It's different. Okay, it's two behaviors. And linked to these two behaviors, there's also this distinction between what he calls anticipatory pleasure and consummatory pleasure. Okay, so anticipatory pleasure is supposed to be a pleasure you will feel in advance, so to speak, before you consume the pleasure. Okay, it's very linked to something Plato said, actually, but never mind. And what he said basically was that, in fact, in depressed people, and even in schizophrenic people, anhedonia is an impairment not in consummatory pleasure, but rather in anticipatory pleasure. And this is a surprise. And this is interesting. Okay? So it's the problem with them is not that they cannot feel pleasure, is that they cannot feel a specific kind of pleasure, which we call anticipatory pleasure. Okay, so it's a kind of discovery in the clinics, but it had no impact, no influence. Okay, it's just, basically, it's just a paper this guy published in the 1980s, and nobody cared about that. Until someone came, whose name is Berridge, very well-known neurobiologist and psychologist, I guess. I think he's a psychologist, too. And what Berridge did is that, as you know, there is a very well-known circuit in the brain that is called the reward circuit, and it was called that because rats compulsively activate it when they are given the opportunity to. If you just put one electrode in the brain, they can self-stimulate. Okay, so this was interpreted as a circuit for pleasure, and what Berridge said is that probably it's not exactly. This dopaminergic reward circuit is not necessary in liking something, but it's necessary in wanting something. You see, it just took the distinction that Klein made between liking and wanting, anticipatory and consummatory pleasure, and he suggested that what this circuit was about was anticipatory pleasure in wanting. Okay? So you have to imagine that these rats are not just giving themselves pleasure. Actually, what they are giving themselves is rather excitation. Excitation about anticipation of a pleasure. You see the difference between being excited to go to a conference and having pleasure in a conference? These are two different things. Okay? So the kind of things that we can... anticipatory, it's a kind of pleasure, of course. You know, when you anticipate something that you think will be pleasant. The same with cocaine, for instance. That would be probably, this is Berridge's hypothesis, you will experience pleasure, not pleasure, as so to speak, but rather excitation about having more cocaine. So the kind of pleasure you have is just like that, excitation. Okay? I hope I'm clear. I will just drop the second part of the experiments. It's very interesting, but I don't have the time to do that. I think this suffices to just outline the problem of framing. Because what is being done here is that we have to choose a very slightly unexpected definition of what anhedonia is about before we define neurobiologically what anhedonia is about. Because anhedonia, I didn't say that, but you could guess, of course, anhedonia is supposed to be to involve this brain circuitry. Okay, so this is a kind of redefinition of a term. Okay, so you change slightly It's not completely different from what anhedonia was supposed to be. It's slightly different from it. Okay, so I think this is very important, because what happens is that you don't have a reduction in the sense that you are deducing that what you observe in the clinic, what you observed in the clinic, from what you discover in biology. It's not either that you are eliminating the notion, saying that, well, it's no use, it's not relevant, anhedonia and so on. What's relevant is this circuit. What you say is that roughly this is the same. That is, there is this partial overlap. And I think this is very important, because this is exactly what happens in when you are reducing, or not reducing, but biologizing something. Okay, it's you won't talk about exactly the same thing, but it's not very different either. So it's a kind of compromise, so that people will say, well, I think this is what we call, this is actually what we call anhedonia. Probably it is. And it's more consistent from a biological point of view. So you can progress in the study of that, and you won't elicit, I don't know, resistance to that. Okay, in an ideal world, actually. Because it not happens all the time. But most of the time, I'd say it's rather like that. It's partial overlap. Okay. So, yes, to just to capture that, the idea is it's that you have to make this trade-off between plausibility, that is, conformity to clinical hues, and the power of new inferences to make. That is, if the circuit that is involved in anhedonia is that one, then maybe we can act upon it with that kind of drug, say, or something else. Okay, so this is very powerful, because we just change slightly the definition, that we can link it to a biological circuit and then act upon this circuit. Okay? So that is the first problem, and just trying to give a hint. Okay, second problem. That one I think I will explain more briefly, just with the help of one, I should take that one. Okay, just to give you the idea. Something I discovered by working with biologists, and I was surprised by that, is that what they usually or commonly do is not experiment on one and the same system. For instance, let's say they have this mouse that they say is a model for depression. Okay, and we do experiments on it, we can draw conclusions, and then we think that we could extend them or extrapolate to humans. Actually, what they do is exactly that, but not on one experimental system, but rather on several experimental systems, different experimental systems. And the result is exactly that, which I also I think is very puzzling. For instance, here I represented the various links of a causal chain supposed to be involved in depression, starting from a genetic defect, polymorphism of this gene, and the result would be a decrease of overall serotonergic neurotransmission in the end. Okay, let's not go into the details. It's not useful here. We don't need it. Okay, so you can see this mutation in the first place leading to, or supposed to lead to, a decrease in a neurotransmission, a certain kind of neurotransmission, itself supposed to be important in depression. Okay? And what I discovered is that actually, how, on what kind of evidence is this mechanism based? And actually what I discovered is that there's no one model, because of problems in experimentation, that you could just study each step always on the same model. Okay? So what you have to do is to study some of them with one model, let's say the white one, okay, which is a model of a knockout of a gene. Then you will study other steps on the second one, that is a special strain of mice. And on another different strain of mice, you will study other elements or steps in the in this process. Okay, is it clear? It means that I should find an analogy, maybe to make it clearer. The fact is that it's just like, for instance, you are experimenting. You want to know how, let's say, a doctor thinks when he diagnoses, and then you take one doctor because he's good at telling you what he does for, let's say, making hypotheses. Okay, so you take him and you say, well, it's good, so we can know well, very well, how doctors make hypotheses. And then you will take another one because he's very good at selecting hypotheses. Then you will ask him, how do you select hypotheses? Okay, and then you gather the results from all these experiments and you say, well, what they all do is that. That I would call a theoretical integration. Because it's a theory. It's exactly what we call a theory. That means that we cannot test every step in the same model. We just, make something like a puzzle, theoretical puzzle. Okay? So this is, for me, this is the second problem. Neurobiologists have to make a theory, build a theory from various experiments. Not just make it up and then test it on models, let's say homogeneous models. No, they have to build it from different models, which means that it's more risky, let's say. Okay, third problem. I'm sorry, I have to go quick. So the problem of consistency is, I guess, the following problem. It's very well known. It's the fact that the target population, so in this case, depressed patients, is not homogeneous, which means that there are very different clinical tableaus for someone to be depressed. It's not a problem in medicine to have different clinical tableaus. It's something very common, actually. You can have different symptoms from the same disease. It's not a problem. But it's not a problem why? It's not a problem because you have or you know the common biological root of this disorder. You know what happens biologically. It's not the case in psychiatry. So how should we know that these patients who have different symptoms actually have the same disease? How should we know that? So this is an illustration of this problem. As a matter of fact, maybe you know that for depression in the DSM, the patient has to present 5 out of 9 symptoms. Okay? Not 4, possibly 6, but at least 5. The fact is, someone calculated that this set of possibilities ends up with 227 ways of being depressed. Okay, so that's if something is heterogeneous, it is something like that precisely. And the fact is, it's even more a problem because, I calculated after that, as you know, probably some of these symptoms actually are alternative symptoms, which is, for instance, they say that you have either insomnia or polysomnia, which means that you sleep too long or not long enough, not enough. Okay? So these actually are two different possibilities, not one. So if you take that into account, this is the number you get. Nearly 1,500 ways of being depressed. So it means that, for instance, if John is depressed, John can be depressed without sharing no symptoms at all with, let's say, Paul. Okay? And I'm not talking about Ringo and the others. So you can have very different tableaus for exactly, which are supposed to be exactly the same disease. Okay, so this is a very important problem also. How should we find our, contextuality, let's say just a word about that. And moreover, it is possible that a major depressive disorder, or major depressive episode, sorry, that is occurring in the context of bipolar disorder is not the same phenomenon as in a what we call a unipolar depression. Okay, you just have depression, or for instance, in the case of schizophrenia. But you can also have depression in the case of in the context of anxiety disorders. Should we consider that this amounts to exactly the same disorder? This also is a problem. Dimensionality is also a third problem. That is, some of these symptoms, not all of them, but some of these symptoms can be moderate, mild, or severe. And you could even be more specific about it. You can score these things with, for instance, one of these scales for depression. These three are the most well known in this field. Okay, so, and as you everybody is aware here, when you have a scale, you have to decide of what we call a cutoff. That is a place you will decide arbitrarily that differentiates the normal from the pathological. Okay. And the fourth problem is that in the field of depression, which is very surprising, I discovered that in others' work, philosophers and historians of the DSM, well, actually there is very little and very poor evidence that epidemiological evidence that this construct is, so to say, is consistent. These are the names the three major ones are very old, and obviously what they showed is just that, not that depression is a consistent group or consistent entity, let's say, but rather that there are various subtypes of depression. And most of them were, I won't go into the details here, but most of them are decided just based on a theoretical assumption, which is very strange. If you read it now, I mean, these papers, Overall, Kay, and Pakel, for instance, if you read it now, you'll see that what the hypothesis they are making are precisely the kind of hypothesis you would make in the 1960s or 70s, which means that they will say, well, there is a very important, consistent difference between endogenous depression and reactive depression, for instance. Okay, which is a distinction that doctors won't use, psychiatrists won't use anymore. And which is strange is that these studies are the ones the DSM refers to. But it has nothing to do with the actual consistency of that. Just a last word on that problem, and then I will go to my last points. It's even, I'd say, stranger. But actually, I discovered in reading, and I asked psychiatrists about that, actually, in more than 90% of the people that are depressed, you can find signs of anxiety. But anxiety is not among any of the 9 items for defining depression. So I asked psychiatrists, and they said, well, it's a very frequent comorbidity. People have, at the same time, depression and anxiety. So I asked, but the definition in the DSM, is it not supposed to be just statistical? That is, the symptoms that come frequently together, you just say that they come from the same disease. And they said, yes, it's the case, but it's not the case here. It's frequent, and it's not in the definition. So what's the explanation for that? And the only answer you can find is that it's a theoretical assumption that depression is something different from anxiety. Okay, there's a huge debate on the links between anxiety and depression, but so I will not go into the detail, but just one thing here, that is for sure, it's not consistent. We should take into account anxiety in the definition of depression if we want to do something just statistical. Okay, so now let me try to explain what I do with these three problems. Actually, I think that you could represent the problems you can find in, say, the framing of symptoms as a space of constraints. That is, you cannot do anything when you are trying to describe a clinical symptom. Okay, so this is one space of constraints. And the problem is that you cannot just take into account these constraints. You also have to take into account the other constraints, that is, those that come from neurobiology and those that come from epidemiology. So it means that you have to take into account at least three different areas with their own rules. Okay, so this is a bit like if you wanted to, you know, play a game, let's say chess here. You are trying to play chess and you're, let's say, a neurobiologist and you are trying to solve a puzzle, one puzzle. And the fact is that at least there are other puzzles too. That is, the epidemiologists have their own puzzle, let's say a jigsaw puzzle. And also the clinicians, they have another puzzle, let's say a Go game. And the fact is that I think these games are not separate, as we saw, at least in the case of the first example I took. When you define something clinically, it has an impact on what the neurobiology is about. Okay? So it means that the games are related. So imagine that you are playing chess. Okay, you have your own game, you know the rules, and everything is fine. And at some point in the time, one person, let's say a clinician, will come and change something in his own game. Okay, he plays something, a move in his own game. He said, well, yeah, well, I found the solution, I should do that. He does precisely that. And what happened in your game? Something changes. Okay, let's say for instance that the pawn, one pawn will move alone, and you have to take that into account. Do you see what I mean? You're not just playing one game. We are playing three games at a time, and they are connected to each other, but we don't know how exactly. So this is a mess, actually, that cannot be otherwise. So the epidemiologist will complain that the neurobiologist will change something, and the clinician will complain that the neurobiologist will change something, and the neurobiologist will say, well, my game is more important than yours, or things like that. You see, this is a picture of the field. I think it is a picture of the field. So what we could do instead is, of course, try to, let's drop that, I don't have the time to do it. The problem is that the thing we could do, I think, and this would be my conclusion, is that we should try to find what the rules of the games are. I mean, not just the rules of each game, but the rules that links each game to another one. Okay, what can change when you change the clinical definition? What change in neurobiology? When you change something in neurobiology, what can change in epidemiology and so on? That would be something that I guess could be done usefully. Okay, and yeah, I will stop here. Thank you for your attention.